From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made on January 19th, when the New York Times announced their endorsement in the Democratic presidential primary process. This time around, they failed to endorse a single candidate, instead choosing two and hereby inventing a new meaning for endorsement. In fact, the editorial board later clarified that endorsement does not mean supporting a particular candidate, in which case, well, I'm confused already, but back to the topic at hand. The Times interviewed candidates at length, and in the weeks leading up to the endorsements, the editorial board released video clips and interview transcripts. For some critics, it looked like a reality TV show, culminating with the Times asking, "Will you accept this rose?" For others, it was remarkably transparent. The interviews were long, substantive, and helpful in allowing the candidates to speak at length on a variety of issues. Here's a quote from the Times endorsement piece, in which they chose Senators Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar. Quote, "There are legitimate questions about whether our democratic system is fundamentally broken. Our elections are getting less free and fair. Congress and the courts are increasingly partisan. Foreign nations are flooding society with misinformation. A deluge of money flows through our politics, and the economic mobility that made the American dream possible is vanishing. Both the radical and the realist models warrant serious consideration. If there were ever a time to be open to new ideas, it is now. If there were ever a time to seek stability, now is it. That's why we are endorsing the most effective advocates for each approach. They are Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar." End quote. This hour, we're asking whether voters care about endorsements, but we're going beyond that. We're asking if there's value in endorsements, and we're asking if there's harm to the journalistic profession when newspapers in particular publish endorsements. Our guest this hour will have a lot to say about that. Our colleague from City Newspaper is the editor, David Andriotta. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here, Dave.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And Michael Killian is executive editor for the Democrat and Chronicle. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here, Evan.
Well, we're going to get to some of the clips because I will say from the outset that I have joined the public conversation in social media and sort of voiced my displeasure at the idea of endorsements at all. That's my bias here. I'd like to see news organizations stop. And I'll tell you why right out of the gate here. We didn't talk about the New York Times editorial board endorsement. We didn't talk about the Des Moines Register's ownership or editorial board endorsement of Elizabeth Warren a few days ago. What we talk about, or what voters hear, is the Des Moines Register endorsed Elizabeth Warren. The New York Times endorsed Klobuchar and Warren. The Democrat and Chronicle in past years may have endorsed candidate X, or in past years, City Newspaper endorsed candidate Y. And what the listeners and what the public hears is the New York Times endorsed that. Now imagine you're a journalist for the New York Times, and what you're telling people is the Times endorsed that. But you're going, not me, and you expect the public to understand that difference. I think it's unrealistic, and I think we have enough evidence to know that it does more harm than good. But I am absolutely open to being convinced otherwise. I'll start with Michael Killian. How do you feel about it?
My views on this have shifted quite a bit over the years. When daily newspapers were read widely and people understood that the opinion page was more or less walled off from the rest of the paper, they may have had a role. Also pre-cable TV days, pre-internet days, right? There was only so much information. We now live in a world where we are awash in information, we're awash in opinion. Not nearly as many people make a daily appointment with news at all, and certainly with the daily printed newspaper, and the concept of an editorial board walled off from the rest of the newsroom is not something the typical citizen would grasp. I think as a result, an endorsement is not as productive or as useful as it would have been, say, 30 or 40 years ago.
Does that mean the Democrat and Chronicle is done with endorsements?
The DNC did not endorse in the 2019 elections, and we are not likely to endorse in 2020. We'll talk more about it. I don't want to say there couldn't be an election somewhere, sometime, or really thought we had to weigh in. But my sense, again, different places I've worked in here, is that we're better off sharing information about candidates with the public so they can make up their minds rather than tell them what to think.
Well, and before I get David Andriotta, let me go ahead, because my hope was to actually, do a cable news style brawl between the two editors today. And it turns out there's a lot more agreement. I say that tongue in cheek. We all know how I feel about cable news. But let me actually read some defensive endorsements before I get David Andriotta's. This is from Chuck Plunkett of the Denver Post and quoted by Big Think said the following, quote, "The idea of that tradition of endorsement, that if you're going to go to the trouble to have a printing press and a newsroom and put your message out and try to cover public policy, then you also have the right as the owner of that paper to express your opinion. That's how an editorial page got started to begin with, in trying to make arguments that would be good for society. The reason we do endorsements is because we're trying to help people understand complicated political questions, whether that's a candidate, as in a presidential endorsement, or an issue like a ballot issue, where the devil is in the details." End quote. And here's Jeff Cohen of the Houston Chronicle suggesting that endorsements are still a vital part of the debate. He says, quote, "We endorse candidates because most contemporary newspapers feel it is part of our public service mission, even if some readers disagree with our point of view. We believe it is paramount for the community and electorate to be engaged and strongly advocate for participation. We think that editorial endorsements help provoke higher thought and cognition and is a motivation to partake in democracy." End quote. All right, David Andrietta, what do you think?
Well, I would say this, that I think that the idea that newspaper endorsements can help the electorate cut through the noise of all the din and chatter they hear on social media and the awash of information that we're all engulfed in, like Michael just spoke of, carries some weight. And that especially goes for local races, down ballot races, that don't get a lot of media attention. So I'm not suggesting that endorsements don't serve some purpose, but I think that in your introduction, I think you hit the nail on the head, and I tend to agree with both you, and it sounds like Michael as well, that I think the general public just doesn't seem to understand the dynamics that are at play in the background of an endorsement, and it raises too many questions about the institution's potential bias. And I think, especially in this day and age, newspapers ought to be very careful about – newspapers or any news outlet ought to be very careful about projecting any bias.
So Michael came close, Dave, to saying the DNC won't endorse it. He said the door is open if there's an extraordinary circumstance, but it sounds like it's kind of a policy change, or at least close to that. You had some decisions to make when you moved over to City Newspaper, because in the past City Newspaper has endorsed, and what did you make of that?
Well, I suppose I didn't have to – well, in short, we stopped doing political endorsements. And that was announced in October, yep, about a month into my tenure here. I suppose I didn't have to make any kind of grand announcement like that so early. But the fact was that I was hearing from a lot of readers who wanted to know whether City was going to do political endorsements. It was something that City readers, I think, had enjoyed in the past. The trouble that I had with moving in that direction and wanting to sort of nip it in the bud was were for a couple of reasons. But the most overarching reason was really that City Newspaper has such a small staff. It doesn't have a true editorial board. So we can get into this, and I think we probably should later in the program, because you referred to the editorial board of the New York Times. You know, these are sort of boards of panels of people who are walled off from the newsroom. There is a strict firewall between them, and it may be hard for the general public to understand, but they are journalists, you know, by every stretch of the imagination. They're talented writers. They're inquisitive. They're asking the right questions, and they sit with candidates for long periods of time, asking very probing questions. Sometimes these interviews go on for a couple of hours with every candidate. And I remember at the Democrat and Chronicle, when I first started there, the editorial board used to do these meetings with everyone who was running for, like, the county legislature, say, you know, all 29 seats or however many were up for grabs that year. And I do think that there's some benefit to that.
I think that's great.
The truth is, though, the city doesn't have the capacity for that, number one. Number two, we don't have an editorial board. And, you know, without speaking ill of my predecessors, you know, Mariana and Bill Towler, they built an institution. I am proud to be at the helm of that now. They have my respect and admiration. But for me, the idea of writing an endorsement that would essentially be my endorsement, or maybe taking a straw poll around the, you know, 12 to 15 people we have in the newsroom.
Including reporters, by the way.
Well, that's
not
what
an
I mean.
Editorial
right.
board. An editorial
there is
board.
No editorial board. Right. I mean, if we wanted to stick to just the reporters in the room, we'd be talking about six people, you know, some of which have never interviewed a political candidate. They're arts writers, they're music writers, they're culture writers, they're dining writers. You know, the political writers amongst us are about three, you know, three or four. And I don't think that given that we haven't conducted those types of in-depth interviews and that in addition, we're going to be calling on these people, these candidates, whether win or lose, they'll still be in public life, you know, over the next 4 years or however long the term is. I just don't think it bodes well for Citi to give its stamp of approval on anyone, especially without an editorial board weighing in. It's just effectively me. And I think it lends to the perception of bias in the newspaper. And I just didn't want to go there this year.
Yeah.
And for the future.
Yeah. And so I take that. But I can't even imagine doing hours upon hours of interviews as we do on Connections with political candidates. And then at the end of that process, a week before the election, saying, well, here's who Evan says you should vote for. I can't even imagine that. But I do think the process of the interviewing is where the emphasis should be. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But let me ask both of our guests if you think endorsements actually matter these days. So because this has been studied, so I have a little bit of information. And I'm not trying to be cheeky. I am genuinely curious. Michael, do you think endorsements move the needle?
I don't think they do in most cases because of the level of polarization that exists in our society currently. I worked at the Cincinnati Enquirer 4 years ago. I was not on the editorial board, and the Enquirer endorsed Hillary Clinton, the first Democrat endorsed by the Enquirer maybe ever. And I can say with certainty it did not change one Ohioan's mind. But boy, did we get a lot of flack and a lot of feedback. In the end, there were better uses of our ink and newsprint than making a choice that instantly some percentage of readership were going to reject and the other liked. The only races it might help with would be lower ballot races that the public doesn't pay much attention to. The problem is we don't pay much attention to those races either. But probably an endorsement in a town dog catcher race might help, but that's not what we're going to do. So,
okay. A very interesting perspective. David, Andrietta.
I agree that they generally don't have much impact. And I noted here in my column from October that I didn't source these numbers in this column, but I'm sure that they're easy to find. And I remember going down the list one by one, counting on my computer screen that the Hillary Clinton endorsements for Hillary Clinton in 2016 outnumbered those for Donald Trump like 20-1. And, you know, we see what happened. Yeah, she won the popular vote, but we know what happened. Pew Research had a study that 7 in 10 Americans say that the endorsements from their local newspaper has no impact. And, you know, just this morning in preparation for the show, I see that something called the Morning Consult. Not sure what that
did
is.
Did you steal all of my research?
Oh, my gosh. Were you going to talk
about
that?
No. You go ahead, Dave. I'll come back in a half an hour.
I'm sorry. But, you know, there was some criticism. Of course, this New York Times endorsement has gotten a lot of criticism. And according to this poll of roughly 5,800 likely Democratic primary voters, before the endorsement, 39% had a favorable view of Klobuchar, who was one of the endorsees, and afterwards it was 41%. Didn't really move the needle all that much. It did move the needle, apparently, among some New York Times readers, but among the primary voters in general, no.
Yeah, and I'll actually cite from two other studies in a moment here. I will say to Michael's experience in Cincinnati, right? I just... In 2020, given the battle that journalists are waging just to try to regain public trust, I don't know why anybody would willingly give any ammunition to any portion of the public that wants to say journalists are biased or pick sides or have it out for our candidate. It just feels like counterproductive in the extreme. But Michael's also keying in a couple, I think, important points here. First of all, yes, most studies indicate that to the extent that endorsements matter, they're more likely to matter in local or smaller, you know, closer to home races. if they matter at all, it's only when they actually surprise, though Michael apparently didn't find that in at the Inquirer. But a study out of Brown University indicates that endorsements can change some opinions. However, the effect is limited if the endorsement is expected. If a major newspaper in a cosmopolitan city known for having a center-left leaning editorial board endorses a Democrat for president, not much happens. On the other hand, a neutral or even right-leaning editorial board doing the same thing can carry some weight. Northwestern found roughly the same. Surprising endorsements had the most effect. Mostly, Michael found it just inflamed people and got you more hate mail.
So, yes.
So there you are. And which, by the way, says when people aren't surprised, they're more likely to say, well, I know how the Democrat and Chronicle, I know what city newspaper, I know what the New York Times, and it just becomes more confirmation.
Right, and therein lies the problem. It just reinforces the perspective that there's a bias.
But the process to which both of our guests, Michael Killian from the Democrat and Chronicle and David Andreatta from City Newspaper, touched on, which is that lengthy process of sitting down and having these interviews, I think it is vital that if you are running for really any office, but especially the highest offices, that you can speak 4 hours at length on any number of topics. And the dodging that happens now on a lot of different levels is really unhealthy. I want to listen, if we could, to some of what the New York Times published from their process. First, you're going to hear from Bernie Sanders. This is you'll hear the editorial board questioning Sanders and some of his response. Let's listen.
What about the fact that Trump has touched a chord in 40 to 44% of the people? What about that issue? It's like Trump is a symptom of a widespread problem.
Yes.
So, I mean, how do you address that?
What is the issue? How did Trump become president? Not everybody. But tens and tens of millions of Americans feel that the political establishment, Republican and Democrat, have failed them. Maybe the New York Times has failed them too.
That explains the appeal of racism?
Yeah. People are, in many cases in this country, working longer hours for low wages. You are aware of the fact that an unprecedented way life expectancy is actually going down in America because of diseases of despair. People have lost hope and they are drinking. They're doing drugs, they're committing suicide. And when that condition arises, whether it was the 1930s in Germany, then people are susceptible to the blame game, to say that it is the undocumented people in this country who are the cause of all of our problems. And if we just throw 10 million people out of the country, you're going to have a good job, and you're going to have good health care, and you have good education. That's all we got to do. So all over the world, Trump didn't invent demagoguery. It's an age-old weapon. And you take a minority and you demonize that minority and you blame that minority and you take the despair and the anger and the frustration that people are feeling and you say that's the cause of your problem.
That's part of Bernie Sanders talking to the New York Times editorial board in the weeks leading up to their endorsement revelation and announcement. Now, the entire transcripts are worth reading, but I find this stuff much more interesting than some of the day-to-day coverage, covering a campaign rally. You get to hear somebody at length trying to diagnose a problem. Now, maybe you're listening to Sanders and thinking, no way here. But I want that insight into how he thinks and diagnoses problems. What do you think, Michael?
I agree, Evan. What City Newspaper and the DNC and local TV and radio canon should do is help readers understand what makes the candidates tick, how they think, how they solve problems, you know, how they handle complex issues. In 2017, the year after the Inquirer endorsement in Cincinnati that didn't change any minds, we did not endorse. I was interim editor at the time, so I was on the editorial board there for a few months. And instead, we brought each of the mayoral candidates in for lengthy interviews. And then our editorial page writer wrote two essays, one on the incumbent and one on the challenger, about who they are, what they believe, what some of their weaknesses were, you know, how they've been challenged over the years. And they were side by side in the Sunday paper and online, and readers could look at what we'd learned, right? And we probably could have done a better job getting some of those interviews out there like the Times did, right? But I thought that was a much more productive and serious way to inform instead of to inflame.
Do you recall, if I can ask, do you recall how that was received by readers? Because I think that's a really intelligent and fair-minded way to go about it. I'm curious.
What I found fascinating in Cincinnati in 2017 and Rochester in 2019, there was no outcry saying, where was your endorsement, right? Maybe a couple stray emails. But so it's not even like the public is waiting for this anymore. Like maybe it would have in 1936.
But contrasting the idea of where's the endorsement, I admit I'm kind of hopeful that you're going to say that you heard from a lot of readers who said, wow, this is a much better process. I respect you more. I'm glad you did it this way. Thanks for letting us decide.
There are times in the newspaper business in the 2000s where the lack of criticism means assent. So by that definition, it was well received.
Is that what you expected?
Well, I actually agree with that. The lack of criticism means that you're doing a good job, or at least one that's viewed favorably by readers.
And Dave, you know, listening to that Sanders clip, there's a lot more, and you know, the Times has published it. I think, you know, the Des Moines Register has tried to be transparent as they, because yeah. Iowa's always first, they get a lot of attention. The reason I think it felt like a reality show is that the Times had this weeks-long leading up to January 19th, we reveal the endorsement. You know, as if it was the will you accept this rose moment, as opposed to we are going to give you the most substantive set of interviews at length that you can imagine, and we want you to flag them, bookmark them, read them at your leisure, but refer to them because forget the quick sound bites. This is what we need more than anything. But instead, it was all about what are we going to say on January 19th? And that was the problem. I think it distracted from the quality of the interviews.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, where else are you going to get that kind of content, that kind of feedback from Bernie Sanders or any candidate? And that interview with Bernie Sanders went on for however long, you know, an hour or more. And I agree with you. The transcripts are worth reading. I haven't read them all because they're quite lengthy, but, you know, I've read enough of them to get a feel for what they were asking. But I agree with you about the reality TV show feel of the thing. I mean, it's my understanding that, or at least the cynics are saying that it was intended to attempt to boost the ratings of the quote, the weekly TV show. And remember, it sort of had the trappings of a one-hour TV show, right? It had the drama builds, and then you cut away, and then you come back. It was edited for that purpose. So yes, it did have the feel of a reality TV show. At the same time, you know, where else are you going to get that kind of insight into the candidates? And one of the great things that we can do nowadays, and newspapers and all news outlets can do it. I mean, we often lament the 21st century and the digital age and what it's done to print and all of that stuff. And that's a conversation for another show, and one that I know you've had a number of times on this program. But one of the things that we can do now is be more transparent than ever and put the transcripts online. Not just the transcripts, you can put the audio online. You know, we routinely hyperlink to court decisions and that sort of thing in our coverage of courts. That's just a minor example. And that's something I think that can be really valuable for readers and, you know, doesn't reek of the reality TV show. That's just putting it all out there. I think it was, is her name Katie Kingsbury? Is she the editorial board editor?
Yep.
Of the Times?
Yep.
You know, she said this was the most transparent endorsement ever. I agree with that.
Yeah, I do too.
But it was also packaged in such a way to make it made for TV.
Yeah.
And that I think that was where the Times fell into a lot of criticism, plus, you know, not being able to settle on one candidate. That was another issue.
the payoff felt like Al Capone's vault, right? And if they had simply said this is the most transparent set of interviews with presidential candidates ever, they would have been correct and it would have been fine. And then we would have thought of it more as a podcast that informed and entertained us, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a model that the DNC will look at this year and beyond.
Quentin, I'm going to get your call in just a second, but let me just say, if for a moment I was working for the New York Times on the sales side, which thank goodness we don't mix that stuff in journalism because I'm not good at it anyway, but I've been in news organizations where some of that stuff starts to blur and it doesn't happen here, thank goodness, and it can be very uncomfortable. But let's just say for a second you're trying to sell, you're trying to actually get attention, you're trying to do the right, all package with doing the right thing. Can you imagine if on January 19th they rolled out their endorsement and their endorsement was, we're no longer endorsing. We think that you should take a look at the entire set of interviews, but it's not our job to tell you how to vote, and we think the process is more important than a single choice. I think everybody would be talking about that. So you'd sell more papers, you'd get more clicks and links, and you wouldn't have people with the ammunition to say, we'll see, I know what the Times was going to do. Anyway.
But what does the salesperson do
nobody calls
next
me.
Year?
Nobody, yeah, exactly. Nobody calls me. Nobody asks me. There's probably a reason for that. Quentin in York, first on the phone. Go ahead, Quentin.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Being a supporter for Amy, I'm also glad the New York Times called her to attention. But I think this discussion happens on the left-wing side of the political spectrum, whereas the right wing is perfectly happy to make all kinds of exotic and often erroneous statements, and who cares? Well, it's nice to have a discussion in politeness and et cetera, but it's amongst the Democrat or left-leaning people that make this statement. And thank you, New York Times. And the other reason that I think a newspaper that you read all the time and you like their opinions, then you want to get the assessment of somebody who's perhaps better read than oneself?
Sure. I take that point that, you know, this is supposed to be, and I think almost always is, a board that takes the task seriously, a board that seeks to be very educated on issues, knowing that the average citizen might not have time to consume super, super extensive amounts of information about the issues. So, I take that idea. What do you think, Michael?
I think that's a good thought. In 1972, so a half century ago, only 57% of newsroom journalists had a college degree. Now virtually every journalist does. So I'm not so sure that the members of any editorial board reflect well the electorate, whether it's in Iowa, upstate New York, or anywhere else. So at some point, you know, it's like the old joke 4 years ago, you know, I don't know anybody who voted for Donald Trump, right? And that's because of the circles in which each of us swim. So short of bringing in citizens from different backgrounds and perspectives to become part of that board, I'm not sure the endorsement has value. I think the interviews do, but not the endorsement.
Okay.
I didn't quite understand what the caller was getting at, to be honest with you, Evan. What I took from it was the first part of the conversation, which was that I guess what he sees in conservative or right wing media, they're not having these types of conversations. They're not willing to sort of look at their practices and procedures. Was that what he was getting at?
I think his perspective is that on the political right, there's less of an interest in a lengthy discussion of issues preceding a discernment of which candidate makes the best possible executive.
Okay, or less of a firewall then between the two sides. Basically,
sure.
Like that the reporting is and the editorial just sort of bleed into one. Well, I think that's true. I do think that's true. You see that on Fox News all the time. I don't mean to make Fox News the villain, but you know, unfortunately, you know, when if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So Fox News, we see that stuff all the time, and I wouldn't disagree with that. But I guess I would argue that I'd rather be in the category of a journalist who is, you know, looking at their practices and their policies and trying to decide what's right, what's best, what's most fair, and take it from there, if that's what the caller was getting at.
Well, after our early break, Chris, stay there. Chris in Rochester is going to call and tell Michael Killian they want the endorsements back. I've got emails. Right on cue, there's people who miss the endorsements. So Michael Killian, David Andriotta are going to hear from some listeners who do appreciate newspaper endorsements, though I would say the bulk of the feedback so far supports the idea that, you know, they're sort of unnecessary and occasionally injurious to the profession. So we're talking about newspaper endorsements. We're talking about whether there's value or harm to the journalistic profession with Michael Killian from the Democrat and Chronicle, Dave Andriotta from City Newspaper, and more of your feedback after our short only break. Coming up in our second hour, an NPR poll finds that 84% of parents, including a majority of both Democrats and Republicans, agree that children should be learning about climate change, but fewer than half of parents say they've actually talked to their own kids about it. And kids can have anxiety about it. So how to talk to kids about climate change? That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. So we've got some support for endorsements. Chris in Rochester. Go ahead, Chris.
Yes, hello, everyone. I will have to say that maybe I'm an outlier here, but I like a newspaper to have a personality. And I think part of what gives a paper a personality is the political endorsements you see during the campaign season. You know, I believe there's a reason why, for instance, if you live in the Boston area, you will probably identify either with the Boston Globe or the Boston Herald, the Herald being the more conservative of the two papers. But I find that the opinion page and political endorsements can help a reader to distill a variety of a flood of information about what the candidate's positions are. And that becomes very important as you get into the days leading up to Election Day. And I just find them very informative. Now, I understand why Mr. Andriotta has found that maybe for the city paper endorsements, it's very different because there's really not an editorial board. But
that's right.
It's disappointing to me, Mr. Killian, that the DNC not only no longer has does political endorsements, but you only have, you know, letters to the editor once a week now. The Buffalo News has an editorial page every single day of the week. And I find that, you know, without doing political endorsements, it greatly diminishes what a newspaper should be about, which is to inform people and to stand for something. And that's where I'm coming from. Thank you.
All right, Chris, thanks very much. Go ahead, Michael.
Chris, thank you for your thoughtfulness. We appreciate it, and we appreciate your readership. I think the key word you used was distill. I agree wholeheartedly that there must be a distillation of candidates' views and positions and strengths and weaknesses on the pages of the Democratic Chronicle, on our website, in our competitors' pages, and elsewhere on the airwaves, because the public does need to have its candidates vetted. But just as we did in Cincinnati in 2017, where we did the interviews and we delivered the distillation of each mayoral candidate, I think that was more productive than at the end saying vote for candidate X over candidate Y. And I certainly respect that we may agree to disagree, but that's where we are now. So my takeaway is we need to make sure we get that distillation right for the New York primary, for school board elections, and then for the general election and such in the fall.
Dave Andriotta?
Well, I guess I would just add that the caller, I'd also add my thanks to the caller and for his thoughtfulness. And it also sounds like he's very savvy and understands the media landscape and understands the difference between editorial boards and the regular, you know, staff. But I getting back to how you opened the program, Evan, I'm not sure that most readers do understand that. And I can't tell you how many times I've been in this business for 20 years, and I can't tell you the number of times that I have had to try to explain that to people, some of my closest friends. You know, I'd be a reporter somewhere, and I'd walk into some sort of civic meeting that I'm going to cover with no pretense whatsoever as to what to expect. I'm there with an open mind, notebook open at the ready, and it's, oh my God, I can't stand your editorial page or whatever it was. And that was whether I was working at the New York Post, the New York Sun, the Globe and Mail, the Democrat and Chronicle. So I've been around. So, you know, this goes, it's everywhere. And then I would have that conversation. Well, you understand that the editorial board is very different than what I'm doing here. Ah, yeah, that's what you tell
us.
That's what they say.
Yeah.
But the truth is, I mean, I'm saying this quite honestly. I remember in the days, as I speak, you know, to my days of the Democrat and Chronicle, you know, there was an editorial editor there named James Lawrence before Michael's time. And he sat in a different part of the building. The only time I would ever interact with him was if he wanted to opine or the editorial board wanted more information on a story that I had written. He would ask me individually if I could spare any of my notes or any of my research or any sources to call. Then he and the editorial board would go source those people out, find them, interview them, see if they could come to the same conclusion. And if they did, they would have some sort of opinion on the piece that I had written. That's a true firewall. But I don't think that the average reader or news consumer understands that those exist. And the truth is, with cutbacks in newsrooms all across the country, those firewalls, I think, are just becoming smaller and smaller. Not that the intent isn't there, but there are just fewer people in a newsroom, so there are a lot of people juggling different jobs.
One other point before, we're getting a lot of feedback, and if you're on the phone, we're going to come to you. If you've sent email, we'll try to read it. Chris brings up the idea that he likes papers to, in his words, have a personality. Let me tell you where my brain went in a couple different directions of this. First thing I thought was, that is not the intention of a newsroom. Newsrooms are not designed to have personalities. However, having said that, just the act of saying those words, I think, comes with the warning to journalists and myself, don't think that you're the only unbiased guy in the room. I mean, I don't believe that people have no bias. I believe it's important to be self-aware of bias. What Chris seems to be saying is, yeah, people have bias, so put it on the table. You can be, you know, this paper will be the left-leaning paper in the city. This will be the right-leaning paper. At least we know that. I don't fully buy that, but I understand it. What do you think, Michael?
He mentioned the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald.
Yep.
Much larger market. And frankly, there were other papers in Boston if you go back 50 years. Unfortunately, where we are now, you know, we are the one daily newspaper, right? And there's many other media outlets. City does a great job. Obviously, there's lots of online social media.
Sure.
We're awash in opinion on social media. But in the end, we have liberal readers and conservative readers. We have moderate readers. We have very political readers and others who aren't at all. We need to inform and we need to entertain. We need to lead, like with Time to Educate, which Julie Philip has guided in terms of pushing leaders to help the city schools get to a better place, serve our children better. But to say you should vote for candidate X over candidate Y, I don't think that's productive or useful, particularly in our polarized society and for our credibility.
Dave, what do you think of this idea of, well, it's good to have the right-left thing. Let's just know personality is good in
organization. I think it depends on what role you're playing as a journalist. I don't think that's healthy for a newsroom in general or a news outlet. If you're a columnist, like I was and still am at City, I write a column. You kind of have to have a personality. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard from people who say, man, I really like your column. You tell it just like it is. And then next week, the same person says, you blew it. Oh, really? I thought you liked what I did. I think there's a time for wearing your heart on your sleeve. But I think in general, the caller was right that the first priority of a newsroom ought to be to inform. And if you are informing, and you're informing with a perspective, which is what columns do, but even when you're doing that, you will still be seen as having a bias. And I'd much rather, at least no one's suggesting in any newsroom that the newsroom isn't filled with people who have one bias or another. But what the newsrooms are trying to do is simply deliver the news without projecting that bias. And that's a different thing.
Yeah. A listener on Twitter, though, says that she doesn't like, in her words, quote, lame attempts to be neutral. She says, I find endorsements to be very valuable. I read the New York Times interviews, and for me, it's about the meat in the process. I know no one who votes for someone because of the paper, but that's not the point. I prefer an educated opinion, even if I don't agree, over a lame attempt to always be neutral. Dave?
Well, I don't think that the Times putting all of the stuff out there and opening up its endorsement process was a lame attempt to be neutral. I think it was a goodwill attempt, good faith attempt to be as transparent as possible.
Okay, fair enough. Michael?
I would say the fact the Times chose two candidates reflects the difficulty of the process to talk to everybody and then put out there who you favor for a large and varied readership. In the end, they split the difference, right? And I think having been in these types of discussions over the years, you're asking a lot of yourself and of your readers to say it's this one over all the others. And so again, let's distill, let's put it out there, let's inform, let's challenge readers and challenge candidates. But in the end, it's the sanctity of the voting booth, what the voter, the reader's going to do that matters most.
I mean, if there was anything lame, I'd say it's the decision to endorse two candidates. I mean, they have one who in Warren, they said this candidate is most likely to rock the foundations, move the United States in a more progressive direction. The other one is Klobuchar is someone who will bring the Democratic Party back to quote unquote normal and America back to normal, what we were before Trump. That, you know,
they're endorsing two totally different things.
Yeah, exactly.
Choose one. Voters have to choose one. The Times was essentially saying to all the voters in the primary process, we are not willing to do what you are about to have to do.
And in theory, they could have
courageous.
Said, and if you want someone who's more of a strong man and is just going to, by force of will, move the country in the direction he wants, vote for Trump, right? By that logic, they could write that as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, right, exactly. Dominic says, weren't the Federalist Papers printed in newspapers they were trying to influence?
Yeah, but newspapers at that time were, you know, served a very different function. I mean, the newspaper that we know of today really didn't, you know, being this sort of ostensibly objective source of news, was something that really came around in the early 20th century. We're probably only 80 to 100 years into this. Sinclair Lewis's pieces in Chicago on the meatpacking district and all that stuff, they were decidedly biased, and they ran in newspapers as well. I mean, newspapers often took their names from being whether Republicans or Democrats or Whigs or whatever the party was. So that was just it was a different time.
Yes.
Okay.
I agree. There was a fantastic piece last week in The Atlantic, The Woman Who Made Modern Journalism, and it's the era that Dave is describing, the progressive era, the very early 2000s. Ida Tarbell worked for McClure's magazine, and McClure's brought together—
20th century, you mean? Early 20th century.
I'm sorry, early 20th. And basically to report, and report some more. Ida Tarbell, she wrote a 19-part series on Standard Oil and really brought to public's attention the power of this one company. And that led to the trust busting and the progressive era and Theodore Roosevelt and bust the trust, everything. And it was the power of her reporting that made the difference. And as the writer in The Atlantic said, it was facts, facts, and more facts, told a narrative fashion built around a central conflict, which describes a lot of David's journalism over the years, right? He's a fantastic journalist. That's where we make the biggest difference in moving our communities forward and helping readers understand issues and then formulate perhaps where we can go. And so I think we need better reporting, better distillation, rather than saying, I favor this candidate over that one. Mm-hmm.
Robert in Fairport, next on the phone. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hey, there was a comment made earlier about down-ballot candidates and the need for endorsements for them because, people may not know the candidates and stuff like that. I think there's kind of a risk for that because if you look at some of the recent controversies we've had in Rochester on down-ballot candidates, Letitia Astacio basically didn't show up for work for about 2 years. And if a newspaper or another media outlet is out there endorsing somebody like that, and those endorsements show up in material from the candidate, which they do, it puts the news outlet in kind of a compromising position to report information that's negative about the candidate.
Yeah, I think, Robert, maybe jumping off of a comment that I made, that I think that newspaper endorsements can be helpful, or the endorsement process anyway, can be helpful to help the electorate cut through all of the noise, and particularly in races that don't get a lot of attention. So I think that's where he's coming from that.
No, I think that, and thank you for that comment. You have to do a lot of research if you're going to make an endorsement. And if you haven't done it or at surface level, you may back the wrong horse, right? And so in the end, what can we distill in local races that's useful, right? And that takes a lot of legwork. And in smaller newsrooms, that's harder. But it's a good point. You know, what can we provide to help people in Greece or Penfield know what who to vote for, or not who to vote for, but what the candidates are, who the candidates are.
And I'd like to just jump in one more time, Evan, if I could.
Sure.
I think Robert, is he still on the line?
Yeah, yeah.
Robert, did you suggest that the information that the editorial board or the newspaper, who's ever making the endorsement, is gathering on some of these candidates just comes directly from the candidate, like from a press release or something? Is it?
No, I'm sorry. I'm saying that when a media outlet steps in and endorses a candidate, that puts them in a position where the news is already curated. If you look at the DNC, for instance, the amount of inches of coverage is very, very much lower than it used to be 20 years ago. So the media outlet's putting itself in a position to further curate coverage because they kind of have a horse in the game. They've kind of expressed an opinion on the candidates, and there may be reluctance to go back against what their prior endorsement may have been.
I see. I mean, I guess I would argue again that if the endorsement comes from an editorial board that has carefully vetted the candidate, I can tell you from experience of working in a newsroom, the news reporters and the news editors who are on the other side of that firewall wouldn't have any issue with tackling a subject that might reflect negatively on the candidate that that the newspaper endorsed. I mean, I think you could look back at some of my coverage in the Democrat and Chronicle on the Brooks administration, the county executive Maggie Brooks, and compare it to the endorsements. The DNC, if I recall correctly, endorsed her at the time, and my coverage was pretty in depth on some of the stuff that was going on in her administration.
I think, Robert, you do raise a good point, though, that in the reader's mind, that question is raised by the fact of an endorsement. And again, that comes back to the credibility of the news organization. And that's a reason why the DNC has moved away from endorsements.
Fair enough.
And even when there is a divided editorial board from a newsroom, when there's an endorsement at all, let's say a candidate gets endorsed, the opponent wins. Some people in politics don't have very thick skin, and they may take it out on journalists. Now imagine city newspaper, in which David, Jeremy, the whole outstanding staff, there is no editorial board. You'd be doing the process of interviewing, choosing an editorial, choosing an endorsement, and then covering perhaps the winner or the loser.
Correct.
Your job is infinitely harder because of that, and probably rightfully so.
Yeah, and I don't think we should necessarily be, we didn't shy away from endorsements because it would make our jobs easier or more difficult.
I hear
but
that.
Yeah,
but
that is a reality. Exactly.
That's a reality. And journalists already are finding more and more people in politics who don't feel like they should talk to them. Briefly, interestingly, the Buffalo News is going to have its third owner in its nearly 140-year history, a sale to Lee Enterprises. And I'm probably behind where the other guests in the room are because they're probably very much plugged in. David, no, you're saying?
No, I mean, I just heard the news this morning.
Okay,
but not overly plugged in. I understand what's going on.
Yeah, let me just read from Spectrum News. The sale for $140 million in cash includes the Berkshire Hathaway Media Group publications with print and digital operations of 30 daily newspapers, more than 49 paid weekly publications, 32 other print products. And for the Buffalo News, this sale ends the 40-year ownership, essentially, by Warren Buffett. Lee Enterprises will be the third owner in the newspaper's history. I mean, I think the Buffalo News is a very important publication. Anything you want to add on that?
Yeah, Evan, it's concerning for lovers of local news. Warren Buffett protected his newspapers more so than a lot of companies were able to, and kept the newsrooms funded at a higher level than what some of the revenue losses over the years, the last 20 years, you'd think they would be. So the Buffalo News has a much larger newsroom for a community of its size than you'll find across much of America in local news. And so you want strong newspapers everywhere, and you wish the Buffalo News the best under Lee, but I do find it concerning.
Yeah, and they were talking in the article that I read that Lee is looking to make $20 to $25 million in cuts, or what they'll call synergies, mostly on the administrative end. I don't know what that means, but I have to believe it means there will probably be a reduction in newsroom staff.
Okay. Would you agree, Michael? Would you not be surprised if there is a reduction in newsroom staff?
That's quite likely.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming in and joining the conversation as we talk about endorsements. And let me also go ahead and the only endorsement I will make, as cheesy as this sounds, is of great print journalism in Rochester, which thank goodness still exists. Obviously, the great work that's being done, our colleagues at City Newspaper and Michael Killian at the Democrat and Chronicle. I've said this so many times, but I think it is important, frankly, vital work. And I'm grateful for it. I think you're doing hard work at a hard time. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you, Evan.
Michael Killian with the Democrat and Chronicle and Dave Andreatta, City Newspaper.
Thanks, Evan, and I echo your sentiments on the DNC.
All right. Thanks, listeners. I mean, a ton of great feedback and really interesting, diverse set of comments there. Surprised us a little bit. Really good stuff. We continue with Connections next hour on WRUR 88.5 FM. A live conversation there. Live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial begins at 1 p.m. on NPR and WXXI.